Welcome to episode 30 of the Upgraded Life podcast. In this episode, I'm bringing you a special interview, a little bit different from the norm, with Dr. Ryan Melton. Dr. Melton has spent the last 10 years of his professional career developing an important intervention for young people that show signs of developing psychosis. Today, a model of intervention exists in large part because of Dr. Ryan Melton and his efforts called ESA. ESA stands for Early Assessment and Support Alliance. So if you're interested in the topic of psychosis and what we can do to actually help people regain and maintain a higher quality of life, then I'm going to invite you to buckle in and enjoy this conversation that I had with Dr. Ryan Melton. Hello, thanks for tuning in to the Upgraded Life podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo. The Upgraded Life is my personal project where I help people realize and reach their potential. I've been a professional helper for 20 years. Here's what I'm convinced of. The life that you have right now and the life that you want tomorrow is a product of your personal mindset, mission, and movement. Each episode of the Upgraded Life podcast is going to give you something that you can do as soon as the episode is over to upgrade your personal mindset. Your mindset informs your mission. Your mission tells you how to move every single day. And together, that is the upgraded life. All right, this is another episode of the Upgraded Life podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Sotelo. And today in this show, I have a friend and colleague of mine. Our professional and personal lives have overlapped several times throughout the probably last decade at least. And So I'm excited to have Dr. Ryan Melton on this show. I'm excited to have him talk about what's important to him in his professional life. And I know that folks that are tuning into this are going to probably get something different out of this episode compared to what we normally talk about, what I normally talk about on this show. But I do believe in the work that Dr. Melton is doing. And I was kind of there when he was on the beginning side of it. And so this podcast is all about mindset. And so I know for him having to create something from nothing, right, and get grants and attract attention and the right type of attention to get it to where it's at today, I know that there's some powerful mindset nuggets embedded in there along the way. So Dr. Melton, I'm going to throw it over to you. Introduce yourself to me, although I know you, but more importantly to my listeners, tell me who you are and what you're doing and what's got you most excited these days.
Sure. Thank you, Nick. So my name's Dr. Ryan Melton. I am the clinical director of the ESA Center for Excellence. ESA is an acronym, stands for Early Assessment and Support Alliance. It's Oregon's initiative to identify schizophrenia as early as we possibly can with the goal to curb any biological, financial, social, psychological consequences of the condition. So I'm the director of the center that oversees the training for ESA programs across the state. And so we have ESA programs in almost every county in Oregon. I think we're missing Lake County, the counties, but every other county in Oregon has an ESA program. My job, again, is to make sure all those sites have the clinical training necessary to implement the program. And that involves the clinical skills, that involves screening, recognition, diagnosing, again, treatment, and ultimately transition, hopefully back to the life that the individual was hoping for prior to coming down with schizophrenia or other psychotic disorders. So that's what I do currently. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been doing this?
I actually was involved in starting the program in 2001.
Oh, wow. Long time.
Yeah, right out of grad school. One of my first jobs, kind of one of those, what we might call happenstance experiences, where my supervisor came into my office and said, hey, the managed care organization is starting a partial grant, should last 6 months to a year, and we're starting to keep young people out of the hospital, particularly people who develop schizophrenia. They put a big emphasis on cognitive behavioral therapy. You're the only one in the office trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, so it's your job. You know, and at that point, it was just an idea. So money and an idea. It was, again, money and idea was what we had. And they actually gave me time to read books and study what was happening in the field. And ultimately, I was involved in designing what became ESA. I think we went from a $600,000 budget to an $8 million budget.
Wow.
Over the past 20 years. A program that was just serving five counties in Oregon when I started to now, again, serving the whole state. And now our model is being recognized nationally, and I contract with several states around the country to implement the model as well.
Wow. 6 months turned into 20 years.
Yep. A temporary job turned into a career. That whole idea of happenstance. And
yeah,
it was really cool. Yeah.
So give me a rundown. Right. Again, for folks that this isn't necessarily a mental health podcast or a psychology or counseling podcast, those that have been listening to this show long enough will know that we hold the same degree, right, in terms of a PhD in counselor education and supervision. So I get it. I understand. I've known you and known your work, but help my folks understand kind of what's the scope of the problem in terms of schizophrenia in Oregon or nationally. What's that all about these days?
Yeah. All right. Well, schizophrenia, a brief overview of what it is. I'm guessing people have a general idea, at least have a vague idea.
What you see on TV and movies, right?
What you might see in the downtown area, people talking to themselves, saying things that are unusual, dressed unusually, those type of things. So schizophrenia can be a very chronic disabling condition. I believe it's the second or third most disabling medical condition in terms of people going on disability, supplemental security income. I think it's recently surpassed or moved up, surpassed cardiac disease, second only to cancer. So just it's one of the most disabling medical conditions out there. So that just gives you one idea of the scope of the challenge. But there's a wide range of challenges. You know, one, just the devastating impact that it has on people's lives. This is a disease or condition, that starts in late adolescence, early adulthood. You know, so for those people with some type of with understanding of how development works, what's happening when you're turning 16, 17, 18, you know, through 20 years old? That's when you're developing your identity. That's when you're trying to figure out what you want to do, whether it be job, family, you know, whatever. And then it just gets curbed by this condition, which takes over your brain, you know, and starts making you believe that certain perceptions that other people don't have are real, or certain beliefs that other people don't have are real. We refer to those as hallucinations and delusions. It also has a significant impact on one's ability just generally to think. It impacts memory. It impacts our decision-making. Just can be a terrible, terrible condition. So the 16, 17-year-old that's in school, we'll say they're doing okay, be average student, you know, with a few friends playing on the football team, life ahead of them all of a sudden goes from that to friends don't want to hang out with them anymore because he's saying things about them, to not being able to concentrate in school, so fails out of school, to now no longer is able to have his dream of going on to college or starting a family, and is on the disability rolls. So it really curves that way. From an overall financial standpoint, we're talking, I presented in my TED talk, I think the data from 2013, we were looking at schizophrenia cost the US $350 billion.
Wow.
You know, so that's B. I mean, not B, billion. There's a tremendous financial burden on everybody. So this is a public health crisis. This is not, you know, a small even if it's even schizophrenia itself as a condition is somewhat rare, the impact of the condition is incredibly high.
Wow.
You know, and we believe, you know, that it doesn't have to be that way. And I learned that firsthand starting in the program in 2001, that if you catch the condition early, you can curb those consequences. You don't have to go on disability. You don't have to be that individual that's on the street talking to themselves, you know, that lost their family or whatever the case may be.
Sure. It's
a very productive life. I mean, we found in our data that if we can catch people within the first 6 months of their condition, like 90% likely to graduate from high school, 80% less likely to go on disability, at least in the time that we follow them. Obviously, sure. Can't have long-term outcomes, but at least in the time that we follow them.
Yeah.
That occurs. So I mean, I guess I would just have your listeners think about it like cancer. I mean, another terrible medical condition. We know if we catch cancer early, catch cancer, say stage one, outcomes are pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, you catch cancer in stage four, the outcomes aren't always very good, if not really good. And that same idea with schizophrenia. If we can catch it early, when it just starts, or now we're even moving into trying to recognize what are the signs that are happening before the illness starts. You know, if we can catch it there, mm-hmm. so much better.
Mm-hmm. So how prevalent is it?
The prevalence rate of schizophrenia is about 1 in 100.
Okay. Right. So I used to talk when I was teaching the 1%, right?
Yeah, about 1%. Yeah. Some studies call 2%, slightly higher in males. Yeah, but about 1 to 3%, you know, what study you read. That's the overall, just prevalence rate.
And then of the 1%, we're talking about 1% of the depictions that we see, you know, dramatized in TV and movies and right now. So I talk about the 1% of the 1%, right? So
right. Yep, exactly. Right.
Probably a lot of the folks that are, you know, struggling with schizophrenia probably don't make good, you know, TV or movie, you know, scripts, because it's not all that exciting, right? Not all that.
Yeah, I mean, the only scripts obviously are the person that's the mass murderer or the demon, right. And are those kind of things, which, you know,
and then,
there's a few.
One thing I saw that you were purposeful to kind of step back and you know, go a different direction, and is disease versus condition. Tell me about that.
Yeah, again, I'm trying to, mindset's important and the language is important. And so I certainly want to change people's language. Some people hear the word disease as if that's kind of a negative thing. And so I use the word condition, mm-hmm. just, you know, kind of a softening that, because it really is. I mean, it really is a set of symptoms, you mm-hmm. know, that certainly can cause people's difficulties. And part of what we've done in our treatment model is to really target those individual symptoms that can get in the way of people's functioning.
Sure.
So trying to send it more of a temporary versus long-term.
Gotcha. Yeah. And then you said, you know, the whole point of your program and what you do is to catch it early. Well, what does that look like? How do you catch it early?
Yeah.
What do you know what you're catching?
Yeah. Perfect. Really great question. Yeah. So that's, again, why I do things like this, why we have to talk about it. I mean, this is considered a prevention program. Prevention only works if you catch it, right? Mm-hmm. If you know what you're catching, you know, if you think about, let's look at, cardiac, you know, patients, or, you know, what are some of the early signs of a heart attack? You know, you might feel some pain in your chest. Gets a little bit numb. That's what I mean, those early symptoms. Mm-hmm. Heart attack yet until, you know, your heart stops, but there are those symptoms early. People don't wake up having schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
Signs prior to the onset. So sure. Some of the signs may look like that the young person, I'll use the word young person very deliberately because this is a young person's condition.
Mm-hmm.
85% of the new cases occur between the ages of 15 and 25 years old. You know, so this is a young mm-hmm. person's condition. So the young person has trouble, starts having difficulty in their thinking. You know, like they aren't able to pay attention in school or instructions at work, depending on where they are. They might become more isolated. We believe that that's because the brain is becoming overstimulated, you know, so part of what we think happens with schizophrenia is that the brain starts to break down in terms of filtering out stimuli that you normally could ignore.
Hmm.
So I sometimes give the example, like, you know, maybe there's a fan or something going on in your studio there mm-hmm. that you're paying attention to until I just said, hey, there's a fan in your studio. Mm-hmm. brain was ignoring it. In schizophrenia, all those little sensory things, the brain just can't ignore anymore. Mm. And it, so it just, it's so that what it looks like from a phenotype or just what the person starts experiencing again, unable to think, they'll even make statements. Like one of the questions on our assessment is, do you ever think that your brain's playing tricks on you? Mm. Or you think something wrong with your brain? Mm-hmm. And that's a common experience that people will start to feel early on, that they think something's wrong with their brain.
Yep.
But they can't think in the same way. They can't concentrate in the same way. They don't have the same memory that they had, you know, prior to. So we're not talking about a long-term, like a person would say, an intellectual disability where that problem, that challenge has been present for life. This is new. Mm. Schizophrenia, we describe it kind of new and unraveling, not persistent. So the 16, 17-year-old starts to experience those changes. And then they start to experience what we'll call attenuated psychotic symptoms, attenuated hallucinations, attenuated delusions. So meaning that they'll think they hear something, you know, maybe it's their name being called, maybe it's a gust of wind, maybe it's a random voice, and it's captivating enough to where they'll be distracted by it. Mm-hmm. Everybody will occasionally think they hear something. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about where it's present enough and captivating enough where the person's now distracted by it. It starts to wonder, hey, what was that? That's weird. And it's happening enough that it's not a coincidence. It doesn't feel like a coincidence.
Sure.
No.
Is there anything to the left ear, right ear in terms of? No. Folklore.
Nervous hold my hand. Or they'll start believing things that are unusual. And it's usually things that that's already exists in our culture. Mm-hmm. So like we have a general belief that the government kind of watches through our phones, you know, or whatever.
Sure.
It just becomes much more captivating to a point of like, geez, maybe I just said something and then something came up on my phone or something, just someone just mentioned the same thing I just said. I wonder if they're able to read my mind. I wonder if they're talking me, you know, those type of thoughts start to come up. So we want to catch it there where I could have a conversation with somebody and say, oh, when you notice that happening, what do you think was going on?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's what we're trying to catch, those early things.
Yeah. So in my line of work, 20 years in youth corrections, you know, I've, you know, attended to cases that were definitely, you know, the diagnosis was schizophrenia and in the crime attached to it was, you know, pretty notable. And I remember one delusion one young man suffered from, at least early on, was he believed that Walt Disney was in a plot to take over the world and that he was going to replace, you know, all kinds of money with the Disney money. And some of that was when the Disney version of Monopoly was released, you know, those types of things. And
Right. So yeah. So usually delusions come from something that's in our culture. It just becomes so exaggerated that it becomes so distracting that the person starts to believe it. Mm-hmm. We want to catch people before they absolutely believe it. Mm-hmm. I mean, technically from a diagnostic standpoint, we don't diagnose schizophrenia as a condition until the person no longer has insight into what's real and what's not. That's what, you know, the American Psychiatric Association and the manual that we use clearly states, you know, they have to lose that insight. So we're trying to catch before that insight as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I remember, again, kind of the same era in my career and developing clinically and learning from our, you know, more seasoned psychologists that as something like schizophrenia is unfolding, that especially young people, I mean, they'll go in from states of being, and I'll use my language, you know, out of their mind to states where, you know, things are pretty normal. And it's that normalcy that they cling to, and they don't really want to talk about this other aspect or side of them. So they'll downplay it or dismiss it. But to, you know, the layperson, even to myself, having some kind of clinical training, and by the way, you know, folks, you know, at the master's level, you really don't get trained to the extent that the public thinks that you do around things like this, right? You, instead of getting a paragraph of it that you might have gotten an undergrad in a psych course, you get maybe a chapter. But in terms of, you know, actual quality training and experience, you only get that by being on the ground and actually doing the work. But it's this tendency to say, well, that person, that they're not schizophrenic. I just, you know, held a conversation with them, or I just played an entire, you know, I played cribbage with them and they were just fine. Well, it's this kind of vacillating in and out of those states. And right. That was a kind of a big aha moment for me. And I can, it makes sense, right? Like a kid gets a pimple on their face. They don't want to tell anybody about it. And they want to, you know, hide it and cover it up, let alone if they think something's wrong with their brain, right? They're probably not going to tell a whole lot of people about that.
No. And yeah, so we're trying to, again, obviously decrease stigma, make it accessible as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, we have our brochures. We did a whole poster campaign in which we used young people to help us design this poster with language from young people to put in every, our goal is to get it in every school in the state of Oregon, you know, so people can see those. And we actually learned from the young people. We said, you know, where's the best place to put these posters?
Right.
And they said, behind the bathroom stall doors.
Right.
It's like the most private place that you can be, you know. So, and we have our QR scan, so you can scan it with their phone. We have our short code, so you can just
nice.
Just subtly walk by the poster and type in their short code, and it'll direct them to our website and how to make referrals. You know, both for themselves and for their friends. We actually learned that from doing this focus group with young people that are at risk of developing this condition. Mm-hmm. They actually aren't as stigmatized by it as adults seem to be. They're like, mm-hmm. Hey, my friend was experiencing that. I really want to help them.
Sure.
You know, there was a lot of that language, which was actually quite refreshing for me to hear. Because I'm like, oh, maybe we are doing something about stigma. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to a professional that's been in the field for 40 years. Like, oh, once someone gets schizophrenia, it's over. You know? Right. So I'm thankful for that. The next generation is actually seeing this as a treatable condition.
Sure.
Their friends that are developing.
Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely seeing that kind of destigmatization of all things, you know, mental health and people needing help. Mm-hmm. Definitely is becoming the norm in the cultures that are coming, or the generations that are coming up, for sure. So
right. Yeah. So ours, we're not trying to hide it. We want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. We want to make, and if people are struggling with it, that they do get help. Mm-hmm. It's such a critical time in our lives, as you're well aware, that late adolescence and then again, having it just devastated by developing a condition of the brain, it can be quite traumatic. It's actually the time that we see the highest level of suicide rate amongst people with schizophrenia is within the first 5 years of the condition.
Wow. Yep.
Probably because they're recognizing. Theory is they're recognizing that something's wrong.
Sure. And is there any truth to it that, and this is what, again, the way it's explained to me is that it's often in their most, you know, rational, lucid state of mind that they'll make that decision because they don't want to go back and experience the other side of it.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Studies will show that people with greater insight into their condition are more likely to die by suicide.
Yep.
Versus someone who's actually, there is a percentage of people that once they cross over into psychosis and they lose that insight to what's real and what's not, they don't come back.
Right.
You know, most people are what you have probably experienced in your clinical practice, kind of in and out.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most common. Mm-hmm. There's a group that's unfortunately once crosses over, even with like medicine treatment,
doesn't
come back as well.
So I was doing a training recently, and I'll make myself vulnerable because you may tell me it was the dumbest thing I ever could have done for them. But trying to get, you know, again, staff, you know, paraprofessional counselors that I may know something about or not, right?
Mm, yes.
Trying to get them, you know, familiar as much as possible with what it might be like for somebody who's struggling with something like this. And so what I did, this was my exercise, and somebody taught it to me, and I really can't remember who taught it to me, but, you know, basically I take a volunteer, put them in a chair, and then I put another staff volunteer in their right ear, another one in their left ear. And then I have another staff in front of them who is actually playing the role of an actual staff, and the person in the middle chair is playing the role of an actual youth. And the staff is giving them directions like, hey, it's time to get ready. It's time to shoe up, time to get meds, whatever it is. But we have them kind of, you know, give them some instructions to draw something. So I'll give them a paper and some pencil, and the staff member is telling them, you know, how to draw. And so, but the person in the left ear and right ear, like one person is telling them the recipe for chocolate chip cookies, and the other person is telling them, you know, I literally opened up like a technical manual and just reading pages out of it, like how to put together your John Deere tractor, and just said go, right? So you get left ear, right ear going, but you got the person in front of them telling them, you know, this is what you need to do, draw this, draw that. And it's just super frustrating. It's super confusing, you know, and the lesson that I was trying to unfold for everybody is, you know, if somebody's really struggling with this and they aren't really following through with your instructions or whatnot, it may not be because they're, you know, trying to be obstinate, defiant, or criminal. Maybe because they've got a lot of things going on in their head and they don't know how to focus on what it is that you're trying to tell them.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great example. I've done similar type of exercises. Yeah, it's, and again, same kind of point. We so much have of the mindset that when people aren't doing something, that they're being defiant, you know, that they're being non-compliant, denial. We use words like this in mental health all the time. And while in some cases there may be some accuracy to it, depending on the individual and the condition, schizophrenia, it's not so much about non-compliance. It's not so much about denial. The condition itself, you know, keeps them from being able to do it. And I've been accused in my career as like, oh, are you just kind of enabling people by, you know, writing everything down for them as opposed to make them write down themselves when given instructions. Same example. I said, no, I actually say that's accommodating for disability.
Yep.
And to me, this is no different than creating a wheelchair ramp outside of your business. We would never a physical disability who can't get upstairs and say, oh, they're just being, they're just non-compliant. And then they're in denial about their ability to get up the stairs. No, we build a freaking ramp.
Right.
That's what we need to do for schizophrenia. Recognize that the condition hijacks the brain.
Yeah.
And that sensory system, particularly people who have hallucinations like you described, is, it's hard to focus when you've got multiple voices.
Yeah.
No, and actually the exercise, how you did it, is actually more realistic, because oftentimes the voices that people hear with schizophrenia do appear localized outside of their head and are often kind of random things.
Right.
It's not, so like the John Deere tractor, or it could be just describing what you're doing. A lot of people describe the voice just repeating exactly what they're doing. Like, look at you walking down the street. Look at you on this podcast right now, thinking how smart you are. You know, just things like that is what the voices are saying. So yeah, it's a nice.
So the next, there's actually, now that that was okay, that you didn't completely laugh me off my show, you know, so step two is this. I say, okay, now we're going to bring on medication to this person. And all I do is increase the distance, right? So left ear, right ear, then I'll increase the distance. They're still doing the same thing, right? But it the experience of the person sitting in the middle is, I still hear it, but it's not nearly as distracting as it typically was. And that was a big eye opener for the people too, because they thought it was like automatic. Like, you give them the medication and it goes away. And that was something that I picked up from, you know, Stephen Hayes from acceptance and commitment therapy, you know, treatment, that, you know, it's like, you know, the medication is going to help, but it's going to provide distance between you and whatever that symptom is. It isn't necessarily going to obliterate it. And so that was really helpful for my staff.
Yeah, it is helpful. The medicines don't work as well as we'd like them to. So that's another good exercise. And people mostly describe about the medicines is it'll mute the symptoms, particularly when it comes to hallucinations.
Right.
I'm a little less bothersome, but oftentimes they're still there. And then of course the medicines have side effects in and of themselves that cause some difficulties in some cases, and maybe in a lot of cases.
So I'm curious, Ryan, have you ever checked out the book Mad in America? MAD?
Yep.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's Bob Whitaker's book. I know Bob. I've presented with him.
Nice.
He's attended some of my presentations. I make my students, I also do teaching, will read, have a choice of reading that book or Anatomy of an Epidemic is the other text that is is really good. I think it's overall, I think that it gives us a lot of food for thought. I think there's some points where I would say there might be some overreaching on the data, but it's definitely food for thought, and it definitely talks about.
So let me go right at that data, because maybe we're on the same thing. So longitudinal studies saying medicated versus unmedicated, there's no quality of life difference, no outcome difference between the two populations. That just blew my mind when he said that.
Right. Right. And so, so some people will argue, well, is it the people that got the medicines, were sicker, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
But yeah, it is that those type of data points are really interesting. The Anatomy of an Epidemic, the chapter on psychiatric medicines and use with children is quite interesting. And some of the outcome data is It's all correlational. Most of that is correlational. So there's still some questions of causation and everything like that. And, you know, he also cites, and I can't remember if it was Mad in America or Anatomy of an Epidemic, the increased applications for social supplemental security income, welfare, you know, for lack of a better word, with that was going up despite all these innovations in medicine that are supposed to be better treatments. We're not seeing people get better, at least from long term. And because we're seeing more applications of Social Security, less applications. So that's something that we as a field need to pay attention to. Now, I might argue, well, a lot of that has to do with how the system is set up and people need treatment. The treatment's incredibly expensive. And the only way they get paid for this is if they go on Social Security, and then it's incredibly hard to get off. So maybe it's more of a system problem than an illness problem. But, you know, that's what we need to, but either way, we need to think about it.
And I think that's in the backdrop, though, that if medication worked like we hoped it did and think that it does, then we ought to see, you know, a decline in some of those things, you know.
And
I can get there on that. And, you know, the majority of the mental health world, that is, as it's driven by, you know, the medical model, will take something like schizophrenia or depression or anxiety and equate it to a broken arm, at least in my estimate. If you break your arm, you're going to know it immediately most of the time, right? You're going to present at a urgent, you know, care or emergency department, and they're going to take an x-ray and they're going to say, yep, you've got a broken arm, right? And we know just how to fix it. We're going to cast it, and in 6 to 8 weeks, you're going to get the cast off, 3 to 4 weeks of physical therapy, and that bone's actually going to be stronger. You'll never break it again. I don't know if there's anything like that, but I remember hearing that as a kid, right? But that's not how conditions, you know, like mental health work. And
it just doesn't work like that. And people, we've tried to study this for years and try to figure out what, can we get that blood draw? Can we get that break? Right. And this is, right there in that spot in your brain. I see it. There's schizophrenia. It doesn't work like that. Oh. It doesn't work like the broken bone. So while there are some advantages to the medical model in terms of providing us with treatment, some disadvantages is that it just doesn't pinpoint the condition in the same way that a traditional, a surgeon might pick up on a broken bone. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. So we have to use observation and interviews, which is an imperfect science.
Yeah.
But we also have an imperfect condition, and it is a condition of human existence, and all humans are obviously quite different. You know, bones are very similar. Humans are very different. You know, I responded to Thomas Enzel, who was at the time the director of the National Institute for Mental Health. And he was writing that we haven't done a really great job with diagnosing mental illness. And we've done our patients and our clients a disservice because of how we diagnose, primarily using interviews and everything like that to diagnose. And he says, we really need to advance the science to really capture it. And then I wrote back, I said, well, I suppose that might make sense in some cases, but are you saying then we should have an EKG for heartache?
Right.
You know, it's just, I actually think there's a lot of environmental factors that I probably use the word brain condition, and maybe that's not completely accurate. This is a schizophrenia, although it certainly has impacted the brain, it's also heavily, heavily influenced by what's happening in the environment. Mm-hmm. You know, when you meet one person with schizophrenia, you've met one person with schizophrenia.
Right.
You know, you're right. Medicine at a specific dose doesn't work for everybody. Some people try medicines on and off for years. Some people prove right away. Some people do actually okay without medicines.
Right.
And then others, you know, benefit from the type of therapies that we do with ESA. We do a wide range of treatment options, recognizing that this is a condition that impacts us at so many levels, and to minimize it just as a condition of chemical imbalance in the brain really minimizes the human existence, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I love that you said that, because I think that's also the trap, that it becomes this kind of revolving wheel of, we just got to find the right med. And, you know, in that book, you know, by Whitaker, Mad in America, when they talked about the deinstitutionalization, and they were pushing, you know, folks that were really up against it out to the streets, and they set up when I say out to the streets, I mean, you know, in group homes and whatnot, right?
Right. Residential places. To
an extent. But they set up the hotline. They set up the hotline for it. And that was another thing that kind of, you know, blew me back, was the number one complaint on the hotline from these former patients was, please don't make me take the meds anymore. I can't take it. I can't stand it. You know, and I was like, wow, you know, yeah. But we put this emphasis and build up around that.
Right. And another challenge, I think, with our treatment approach is that we actually make some level of assumption that people have enough insight and ability to walk into a practitioner's office and say, oh, hey, doc, I have schizophrenia.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I've been doing this for 20 years now. I've never had a first person that breaks schizophrenia say, hey, doc, I have schizophrenia.
Right.
Not what they're saying. In fact, again, the definition of schizophrenia is they've lost insight into what they have.
Interesting.
And again, we call that Xavier Amador in his book, I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help, which I think is a brilliant book in kind of understanding mental illness, you know, describes the process of anosognosia, you know, which is basically a lack of insight. You know, in the medical world, if someone has a stroke and can't use their right arm and we say, hey, pick up this pencil with your right arm, and they say, oh, I did. They don't say, oh, and the person actually didn't. They don't say, oh, this person is in denial or refused the pencil. They're saying, ooh, the person's suffering from anosognosia. The left and right hemispheres of the brain are not communicating with each other.
Right.
Same thing happens in schizophrenia.
Gotcha.
We force people to come in and say they have schizophrenia and then take a medicine for a disease or condition that they don't even think they have. And then that condition that we ask them to take the medicine that they don't think they have causes significant side effects.
Right.
So, and then we call somebody non-compliant when they don't take it.
Right.
So we've had to, at least at ESA, one of our models is really, one, we try to prevent that altogether. But if we can't prevent it and we catch people early where they do meet, say, criteria for schizophrenia, meaning they've lost insight, we're all about engagement.
Yeah.
And it's not about you have a medical illness that needs medicines. It's about what interests you.
Mm-hmm.
What is not present in your life right now? Maybe we can help you get. I acted as a psychotherapist for most of my career when I was working before I started educating in the field, when I was working in the field. But some of my therapies involved playing basketball,
mm-hmm.
you know, just to get to somebody. And so, you know, and I engage people in treatment by saying, hey, we can probably improve your game a little bit.
Yeah.
Get some of those skills back. Let's get that balance back. Let's get that concentration back. I'm wondering what ways we can do that.
Yeah.
You know? So medicine, sometimes we're never even about improving schizophrenia. It was about improving my jump shot,
right?
My sleep,
yeah.
Ability to have a relationship with someone I care about.
Mm-hmm.
We had to do that because otherwise, if you just come in with you're sick, you need to take this medicine, It makes an assumption that the person can recognize that. And with schizophrenia, they can't. And it's not that they can't.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction, I think.
Yeah, that's a great showcasing of the power of a relationship and the power of rapport and client's voice, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You want to talk to me about all this schizophrenia stuff, but I really want to jump on my jump shot. I want to work on my jump shot. Let's talk about that. Okay, let's talk about that. You know,
Let's talk about that. We're talking 17-year-olds.
Right.
That's what's going to be important to them. Yeah. I've had many treatment plans. My treatment plans didn't read to reduce the symptoms of my psychosis by 70%. My treatment plans read to be able to ask this girl out.
Yeah, you know, yeah, absolutely. Because that's the flip of a symptom of, you know, having shame or you wanting to suppress, you know, a condition. Yeah, I love that. So a couple of thoughts that went through my head as you were talking about it, and I'm trying to resist, you know, delving into my own kind of brushes with this, but I may not be able to resist it. But I remember being taught, you know, at the master's level graduate school that when you do find yourself in a situation where you're asked to work with somebody like this, that from their perspective, their story makes sense. And one of the things that can be done that can be really effective, and I've done this, is hang in there long enough, get enough exposure to the story so that you can see from their perspective how it makes sense.
Right.
Is that a worthwhile endeavor from your experience? Or
absolutely. I mean, yeah, seek first to understand before you can be understood. I mean, it is, we have to sit with that you know, just hearing, and you're going to hear things that are going to sound incredibly unusual to you.
Right.
Yeah. You know? And you, you're going to have to sit with them. You're going to look for the themes. You're going to look for meaning behind what they're saying. You're going to look for the impact. I mean, even though what they say, what they may be telling you may not be your reality,
sure,
but how that reality is impacting them, you probably can agree is causing difficulty or is painful to them. I mean, for example, if somebody believes that the federal government is sitting outside of their house watching them all the time, you know, men sitting in a van, you know, recording them, we may not agree that that's real.
Sure.
That they're really, they aren't really out there. But what we probably can agree on is that if that was happening to me, I would be really scared, and I could completely understand why I wouldn't want to leave the house either.
Yep.
And so that's what we have to focus on, is more of the impact of the belief and the belief itself.
Right. You know, yeah, I like that.
Our approach is.
So there is, you know, recently two years period for me, the two cases that really kind of were good that I experienced, because I was able to actually show, you know, kind of a younger team of clinicians, kind of a different way of doing this, and that piece of sifting through the story to see how it makes sense. So I had a young man, and he, and street drugs were involved. And I know it's kind of a different scenario, but, you know, I think at his core, it's at least a schizophreniform or a schizotypal. You layer on street drugs, and man, it was a whole different presentation there. And we had to put him in an isolation room, and I know it sounds terrible, but that's you know, corrections, that's, you know, going to be the primary intervention, at least for the immediate safety of him and other people around them. And, you know, we station a staff outside the door to continue the dialogue and whatnot. So I had heard that we had put one in there and he wasn't doing very well. So I made my way down there, cause I'm responsible for that area and the staff that are there and any young people that come through. And I asked the staff, I said, is he okay? He's like, yeah, he's been pretty okay. And, but he's buck naked in his room. Right. I mean, and sure. He's pacing. And, so I, you know, said his name, and, you know, he's kind of looked at me, stopped his pacing and stared. And then I made the mistake, you know, instead of asking him like, what's going on? I said, hey man, what happened to your clothes? Oh my gosh. He erupted. And what he was telling me was what he was concerned about was the fact that he had 18 kids, and in the room that he was in, there was already a calendar that was scrawled on the wall, and he got jumped down, and he told me, like, I got to get my kids to the doctor, and this kid needs to go see this one, and you're asking me stupid ass questions about where my clothes are. You need to let me get out there so I can take care of my kids. And I looked at the staff and I said, I thought you said he was okay. He's like, he was until you talked to him. But I made that critical error of, and you know, of asking, hey, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Maybe he would have told me that story of, I got these kids out there and I've got to, you know, can you help me? And, but I was able to kind of get back there. But when I asked him, hey man, where are your clothes? Yeah, that was his way of getting us to take him seriously. Like, you're not listening to me. So I'm going to take my clothes off and be naked. So that way you'll take me serious. And, so I kind of had to, you know, knock off the rust from my direct care days and whatnot. And was able to kind of showcase that to people. And then as he got better, you know, he would start to say things like, man, it's kind of weird that I don't understand why I think that I have 18 kids. And by this time it was like 54 wives. And he's like, I'm not even old enough to have that many kids and that many wives and whatnot, you know, and really trying to caution the staff, like, yeah, don't just listen and just validate. Don't say, yeah, dummy, you've only been around this planet for 17 years.
Right, it doesn't make sense. How would you have 54 kids? You know, those kind of things. Don't do that. Right.
Right. Yeah. Don't do that. And so it took a little bit of them to get there to understand that.
Yeah.
The other young man, and kind of like what you were talking about, the accommodation that we make. Mm-hmm. And this guy was struggling so much. And these are both young men, by the way, that ended up being transferred to Oregon State Hospital for some kind of crisis stabilization, right? So they, in terms of what I see, that they're the most acute cases that we'll come against. Because usually what I say is that we've got the kids that the state hospital won't take.
Right.
And these two, they ended up taking them and helping us out. And we're grateful for that collaboration. Mm-hmm. But this other guy, he you know, and that's where, like, you know, again, correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert, but, you know, I've understood that it's fairly common for folks, especially on the front end side of this, to start to try to make sense of their experience. And one way that they can make sense of it is they'll journal about it. They'll write it down, right? So that way they can come back to it and maybe confirm for themselves, like, no, this really did happen. I wrote it down here. Anyway, So we had a young man that whenever somebody would approach him, he would start a conversation, but then he would demand that they go get paper and write it down. Mm-hmm. Right. And he would get really insistent about it. And then we kind of had the discussion as a clinical team. Well, that's ridiculous. I don't have 3 hours to listen to this guy and write his story down. And another person said, yeah, I'm not going to do that. That's ridiculous. And this, unfortunately, is the corrections layer that comes on top of working, doing the work and not being manipulated. And I'm like, whoa. I said, you know, what's our general kind of outlook on what drives, you know, psychosis? And, you know, at some basic level, it's somebody trying to make sense of their experience, right? And if you couldn't track a conversation from one person to the next, or from one moment to the next, or one day to the next, you probably would want somebody to write it down for you too, right? So trying to get people to kind of just back up a little bit and make sense out of the story. And another kind of interesting part of his deal was on the living unit, he saw another young man get significantly helped by a medication, and it was a psychostimulant ADHD. So he got the ADHD diagnosis, got the psychostimulant, and did really well, got better going in school, and ultimately paroled. So then he took that on himself, that if it worked for this kid, it's going to work for me. And then became insistent with our prescribers and everybody that I need what worked for that guy, because I want to get out of here. Long story short, he ended up going to the state hospital, and then he would say this thing like, it's going to happen. And when it happens, you're all going to know it. And it was on repeat. Somebody said, hey, I checked in with so-and-so. And I said, did it happen yet? And we would kind of get a chuckle. But when he came back from the state hospital, once they kind of got him stabilized, so he ended up getting a medication that he shouldn't have on the unit, group living environment, and he took it, right? But he didn't really get the it's happened result. So he believed that it hadn't metabolized yet, and it was still left in his system somewhere. But at any given time, it was going to metabolize, and it was going to make him better, and we're all going to recognize it, right? But we didn't get that full loop circle, because the state hospital kind of called and said, yeah, man, he's saying, I'm like, oh, it all makes sense now, right? It all makes sense. So being able to kind of put those pieces of the puzzle back and then show the clinical team, really, you know, help them establish, you know, what it really looks like to listen and just hang in there in their story. Okay. Because they would try to talk him out of it, and that's when he would get aggressive. It's like, don't do that.
That's the one thing I advise. Once somebody is kind of crossed over that has insight, that should be off the table. Mm-hmm. This whole idea to help by somebody gain insight into a belief, whether it's I had 54 children or the government is tracking me, or as unusual as it sounds to us, our experience. I mean, that's, we really have to focus on the feeling, you know, at the very least do something that we call in CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, collaborative empiricism, which is we start asking questions about it. Tell me how that you came to, you know, have children or something like that. We don't want to collude either. You know, saying, have 54 children. I know you do. You know, we're asking questions about it as if we would anybody else.
Sure.
The training mechanism, going back to your idea and training that I do to help trainees understand this concept, is that I will pair them up and I will have them come up with an idea they have, a belief that they have, a real belief they have that a good portion of the population may not believe. The easiest one is politics. So it has to be somewhat safe to do it. So if you have a certain belief about, let's say, gun rights or, you know, drug testing people on welfare, whatever it may be,
right.
You know,
abortion.
And this is a safe enough room. Share that idea with your partner.
Right.
You know, and now your partner's role then is to unhear you and then try to nicely be nice about it. Don't say, oh, yeah, it's an idiot. You just, you know, this. That, you know, don't call names like what happens on Facebook. Be nice about it and say,
be professional, right?
Yeah, be professional about it, but try to talk them out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, have you seen the stats on what certain countries have done with gun control or whatever? You know,
right?
Just try to give them evidence, talk them out of it. And I'll have them do that exercise for a while.
It's a great
and
then one.
Back to the client or the person that shared their belief, and I say, how many of you changed your mind?
Right.
And the answer is zero.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, because you just, that's not how we change people's mind. We all have beliefs and we all have strongly held beliefs. Anybody comes in and tries to change our mind by telling us we're wrong, even if they're nice about it, we can come up with ways to explain it.
Yeah.
You know? And so then I said, now the exercise is do it again, but this time ask questions about where the belief came from. Ask them where their experiences were, you know, ask them about, you know, where do they learn about gun control or whatever it is, you know, what's their belief about that? And then just have them just talk to them about it.
Sure.
And so the idea then is, you know, if you, the first approach, you know, it's unlikely that that client's going to ever come back and see you again. At least the second approach, they may not have changed their mind. That wasn't the goal. The goal wasn't to change their mind. The goal was to kind of build alliance, keep talking, and to understand each other.
Yeah. You know? And not only might they not ever come back and see you again, they may not ever seek help again. If that's
they what they might not seek help again. Yeah, I honestly believe that's why a good portion of individuals with schizophrenia are in the streets, is that, you know, they got help at maybe early on, maybe they were hospitalized, but we came at them, you know, we thought of it well-intentioned, you know, we're trying to normalize it. You have this medical condition called schizophrenia. It's like any other condition, like diabetes or like a broken arm, and you need to take these medicines for it. That works if the person believes that that's what's going on.
Sure.
And it just doesn't seem, that's not always the case. And a lot of statistics will say anywhere between 45 to 50% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia don't think they have schizophrenia.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good portion of people that out there. So we just have to take a different approach. And that's the manual that I was the lead author on for the ESA manual. It talks about how do we engage people in that, you know, in that way.
Sure.
And we have to let go of as a mental health profession, you know, I even talk about some of the myths that we believe in mental health, like we got to get people to gain insight. Nope, that's actually not as necessary with schizophrenia. We need to have them gain some understanding of how treatment could be helpful in their lives somehow. We don't need them to understand specifically, I have a major mental illness called schizophrenia and I need to take an antipsychotic. We don't need to do that.
Sure. Yeah. Now, for better or for worse, I will lean on, you know, the Hollywood movie Beautiful Mind to kind of show some of these things. What's your take on that? Is that a good depiction or?
Well, Beautiful Mind is an interesting movie in that, I mean, I appreciate that Hollywood actually produced a movie that sends a somewhat positive image of schizophrenia.
Right.
So that's what I can really appreciate about Beautiful Mind. So you've seen it. Hopefully some of your listeners have seen it, because I'm going to spoil it right now.
Spoiler alert. Yeah.
Right. So you can look at the time frame on your podcast. You go about 5 minutes into the future. But, you know, in that movie, you know, John Nash came to realize that he had a condition because these hallucinatory experiences that he had, these figures that followed him throughout life, never aged.
Right. Yes.
Right. And so he gained that insight because of that. That type of hallucinatory experience almost never happens with schizophrenia. You know, so you
mathematician, right? So
right. Now his paranoia, how he's kind of described his paranoia, that was actually a fairly accurate depiction of how someone may experience schizophrenia. But the hallucinations of seeing things, actually, it's a little bit of a misunderstanding in schizophrenia that the primary type of hallucinations that people have with schizophrenia is auditory. So hearing something that's not there, rarely, if ever, do they see something that's not there? And that's a different disorder.
Sure.
Oftentimes. And that's another thing that we do in ESA. We really try to distinguish, you know, what's happening, because one, we want to make sure we're treating the right people. We're treating people either with early schizophrenia or could be developing it. You know, people that have visual hallucinations, that could actually be a drug issue. You know, that could be a trauma issue.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure that people have the right treatment, because we're not a trauma program. We're not a substance use disorder program, even though some of these things cross over, and if they have schizophrenia, we'll treat all of them, but that's not our primary mission.
Interesting.
So we will do that. Yeah. That's a big part of what we do up front. And the reason why I'm telling the story is that I use A Beautiful Mind to kind of describe that. Good movie in terms of reducing stigma and sending a positive image, but at the same time, that's not, that portion of its experience isn't an accurate description of schizophrenia.
Perfect. So one thumbs up, one thumbs down.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the people that are listening to this, that are parents, their friends, their family members, what suggestions, what advice do they give? Would you give them about their concern that they may have for a loved one, mm-hmm. and what can they do about it?
Yeah. So the good news, well, if you live in Oregon, the good news is there's an ECE program unless you live in Lake County, unfortunately, but outside of that, there's an ECE program in every county in Oregon. So if you're, whether it's your child, whether it's a member of your church, whether it's your teacher and it's someone in your class, when you get to go back to class, it's your coach and you're seeing just behavior that's changing. And that's really what we're talking about here. Something that's changing, not wanting to hang out with people as much anymore, seemingly more confused, grades dropping, spending more time in your room, hygiene going down, spending a lot of time focusing on things that's going above and beyond. So it might be focusing on media reports excessively or digging into the Bible. And although you may be a religious person, really digging into it and, some that's above and beyond. If those type of symptoms are happening, there's a couple things they can do. One, they could call one of the local ESA programs, wherever county they live. They're in Marion County. Marion County has an ESA program. And you can find that information on the ESA website, esacommunity.org, EASA community.org, and click on ESA programs. It'll list all the programs. It'll tell you exactly how to refer. You can do that. Also on our website, we have a survey that anybody can take that will throws off a list of questions. I think there's about 20 questions in this survey. And from that, we can tell you whether or not we're concerned or that mm-hmm. concerned enough to talk to somebody. And again, if you take that survey and it says, hey, would you like to talk to someone from ESA further? It doesn't mean we think you have the condition. We just believe based on your responses that you're at slightly higher risk. And we would like to talk to you and make sure that we can then do more advanced assessments to give you a clearer idea what may or may not be happening. So we can certainly do that. So I definitely encourage people to do that. And please don't wait.
Sure.
We've spent the last hour or so kind of talking about some of the stories that can happen with schizophrenia, some of the stories that you've experienced in your work. Again, my job really is to prevent that. Mm-hmm. My job is so that your staff at the corrections unit don't see people with schizophrenia, sure. because we've caught it before something happens where they've committed a crime. And a lot of crimes that people with schizophrenia mm-hmm. commit are sometimes property crimes. I mean, we've had people go into people's houses thinking they live there. A lot of confusion, those type of things. Sometimes violence does occur because they believe that someone's trying to hurt them and they defend themselves and things like that. So that's our job, is to really try to prevent this. So please don't wait. If you think that something's happening, we'll tell you if nothing's happening. This is a full public health program. This is not, aren't paid based on the number of people that.
Right.
This is a completely free service. Also, I should stress that ESA programs, we'll bill insurance, but it's going to be free to you. And if your insurance actually comes with copays, we don't actually charge you those.
Nice.
So it's really a free to you program mm-hmm. with bill insurance. And if you don't have insurance, it's a free to you program.
Nice.
Because, we can't just prevent schizophrenia in people who have insurance. Mm-hmm. We have to, again, a public health, $350 billion. We've got to kind of take a whole widespread, mm-hmm. Approach to treating this condition. So early, you'll work with some of the most trained professionals in schizophrenia. I mean, members of the ESA teams, that's what they do.
Sure.
That's what they specialize in. So they can tell you what they're concerned about.
Awesome. So Dr. Melton, for folks that are more interested in your message and what you're doing, you did mention that you had a TED Talk. So how can people find that TED Talk? How can people find more of what you're offering this world in terms of helping people have better quality of life? Where can people find you?
Yeah, I think so. First and foremost, the website, that's probably our best way. So esacommunity.org, go there. That'll describe the program, how to refer, a ton of resources. So even if you are of somebody who either has schizophrenia or a family member that has schizophrenia, and it's been a few years, so ESA wouldn't be as helpful now. There's a ton of good information on that website, which
great.
you can use. So that's where you're going to learn mostly about it. And then my TED Talk, you can Google Ryan Melton, TED talk and it comes up. So,
we can guess, but what's the basis of your TED talk? Is it early assessment?
It's early intervention, just about those early warning signs. Actually, a lot of what we just talked about, I compare and contrast different stories we can do with their early intervention. And I talk about some of the savings that we can have. And of course, to destigmatize this. It's
for sure.
How to really approach it. And that's and really one of our best approaches to schizophrenia that we know now that almost definitively is shown in the literature is the best treatment for schizophrenia is to prevent schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. And you've shown there's tremendous hope in that, right? That there's, that the outcomes and the quality of life doesn't have to be that far off from what you thought it was going to be with the early intervention and early detection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So just like anything else, you know, we know that with substance use, we know that with depression. If we can prevent this. And again, one thing ESA will do, if it's early on, if you have a loved one gets hospitalized, say at one of a psychiatric hospital, if that's new, we'll work with them also and then take that approach of very creative engagement.
Sure. You know. Well, Dr. Melton, I really appreciate you taking time for me in this podcast. And absolutely. I know that I learned several things, and I'm guessing that my listeners will have learned a ton. And I really appreciate you and the fact that you took 6 months of dedication and turned it into 2 decades.
Right?
And that just tells people, you know, be careful what you say yes to and make sure your yeses are to a worthy endeavor, because 2 decades can go by like that.
It has gone by like that. Yeah, it has, for sure.
So I appreciate you, sir, and all that you're doing, and you know, showcasing this as you know, it's a public health concern, right? And it's one that there's hope in that we can actually do something. And
we have evidence that we can do something about this.
Yeah, because for far too long it was labeled as, you know, basically a dead end road, right? Once you know, there's nothing we can do about it. It's a brain disease, and once you got it, that's it. So, and you're proving them wrong, and I appreciate that.
You bet.
Thanks again for coming on.
All right, thank you. Have a good evening.
I'm so grateful for Dr. Ryan Melton for taking the time to come and speak to me, speak to you, all about the condition of psychosis and the work that ESA does. And remember, ESA is an entity, it's a resource to help detect psychosis early so that we can intervene. With that early intervention, we can help people who are prone to develop that disorder to get the help that they need in order to keep that disorder, to keep psychosis from consuming their lives. So ESA and Dr. Ryan Melton, they're doing incredible things to help the people around us. I mean, folks that are at risk for developing something like psychosis, they're our neighbors, they're our family members, they work with us. They're everyday people that deserve the best attention possible. So hats off to Dr. Ryan Melton and all the work that he has done to help ESA get up off the ground and become something more than just a local county program. He helped bring it to the whole state, and now he's taking his message all around the world. So if you want the websites and all the info about ESA, I'd encourage you that if it's something that's near and dear to your heart, donate to the program. Help promote it. Share this podcast with somebody. I know that there are people right now that are out there and they're looking for answers and they're looking for hope. You may be able to help them connect to those answers and help build up the hope that they are looking for just by sharing this show with them. As always, to follow up with this show and the content and with Dr. Ryan Melton, head over to my website. My website is www.nicksotelo.com/TUL podcast, the Upgraded Life Podcast. While you're over at my website, don't forget to check out the 3 opportunity buttons at the very top. They are scheduling a time with me. I'll give you a free 30-minute strategy session. Checking out CBD products from Nature's Ultra. And then also, if you're looking to create an additional stream of income, I can help you out with that too. This takes 20 minutes of your time. Click on the button that says Income Boost. Give me your name and email, and I'll send you a presentation. Thank you again so much for listening to my show, the Upgraded Life Podcast. If you got something out of Keith Weber's information, his info on kettlebells and mindset and just his overall story, let me know by going over to Apple Podcasts, leave me a 5-star review, and that will tell me that you enjoyed the show. This is Dr. Nick Sotelo, and I'm urging you to do something today to realize and reach your potential, and I'll catch you on the next show.